In 1999, a 7.6 magnitude earthquake struck central Taiwan, killing more than 2,400 people. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 51 degrees with rain. In New York City, 41 degrees with rain. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM. Good afternoon. This is Zain Al-Amin with the Shai Rana Show that airs every Wednesday and centers on the Arab world, which is, as you're finding out, inextricable from our world here in the United States, as billions of dollars are being sent by the Biden administration to kill innocent children, women, and men in Palestine. To give you an idea about the savagery of Biden and Netanyahu and the Israeli government and the U.S. government and our so-called representatives, they talk a lot about ISIS and the evil of ISIS. There's two things to know about ISIS. One is that ISIS was formed in the petri dish of U.S. occupation in Iraq, in the Abu Ghraib prisons. That's where ISIS was nurtured. It's really interesting that ISIS has never attacked U.S. interests or Israeli interests, in the sense that the only time it hit Israel, it actually apologized for it. In the meantime, they went on an extermination campaign when they had a presence in Syria and Iraq to kill all not only non-Muslims, but also within sects that are non-Wahhabists, basically, killing them, targeting Shia, targeting Christians, and saying that killing them is actually acceptable. Now, that's how ISIS was formed. But the reality is, what happened is that in terms of the bombs that were dropped on ISIS, just to give you a comparison, as evil as they say ISIS is, which it is, they dropped the biggest bomb that the U.S. used on ISIS was a 500-pound bomb. Now, Biden is giving 2,000-pound bombs to Israel to drop on children, women, and Palestinian men, innocent civilians. He's giving them these bombs, 2,000, four times the weight of the bombs that were dropped on ISIS. So that tells you what this is all about, the slaughter that Biden, and that's why I love it that he got slammed in Wisconsin, where they were expecting to have 20,000 uncommitted votes, and they ended up with 46,000. It's really important that he loses the race. It's really critical that nobody that commits genocide is ever elected. And I know liberals are out there are now whining about the greater evil of Trump. If Biden loses, it's his problem. Not our problem. It's his problem because he committed genocide. And the only thing that you can come up with is that Trump is going to commit a bigger genocide. And that's the downward spiral that we've been on, that I talk about and harp about every week. The other thing is that recently, another recent event, before we move on to our clip of the day, is that we First of all, Al Shifa Hospital was attacked by Israel systematically because this is a genocide. This is ethnic cleansing. That's why they've killed more reporters than any in any conflict in recorded history. That's why they're attacking every hospital. That's why the hospital workers have to take off their scrubs when they go outside of Al Shifa Hospital, because the snipers were instructed to shoot the scrubs, anybody in scrubs, kill all hospital workers. And this is totally acceptable by these Biden and his chief of staff and Blinken and all of those that are, every time something like that is mentioned, they're saying we're looking into it. The other thing is the killing of a member of every country whose government has supported Israel without accountability. They recently, the attack on the World Central Kitchen that's led by Jose Andres, they basically killed an Australian, a Canadian, a Brit, and a Palestinian. They don't mention the Palestinian when they're mentioning the who was killed. And so these are all countries whose governments refuse to admit that this is genocide and are actually contributing to the genocide, except for Canada, which has stopped arming Israel recently, but still refuses to acknowledge there's genocide going on. So that's what happened with the World Central Kitchen. There's a global outcry about this because, despite what Netanyahu said, that this was unintentional, it was intentional. If you heard the details, there were three cars. They hit the first car, which is clearly marked and which has been given permission by the Israeli government to go from point A to point B, and they hit it while it's going from point A to point B. The wounded were transferred to another car, and the drone hit the other car, and then the wounded were transferred to a third car, and the third car was hit. And that was all unintentional. And if you believe that, I have a pier to sell you off of the coast of Gaza. The last thing I wanted to talk about is the iftar that Biden had. He wanted to celebrate after all of this. He's so clueless. The man has dementia. We have the president of the most powerful country in the world with dementia inviting Muslims to an iftar. Of course, no Muslim that w didn't want his reputation smeared showed up, so they had to cancel the iftar. And the one doctor that showed up basically showed up so that he can walk out on Biden after putting his 2 cents, and refused to break bread with him. So he's lost the Muslim community. I guarantee you that he's lost the vote on the Muslim community. It's not our doing, people. It's his doing. He is destroying your democracy. We're not. Trump isn't destroying your democracy right now. He's the one, the most active in destroying the democracy. And it's very clear that our representatives care more about Israel than about our health care, which they've given free health care to Israel with their subsidies. They don't care about our higher education, with student forgiveness and all that. And even while the Democratic Party had control of the Senate and the House, they had control of the Senate by 60 senators under Obama, and Obama didn't do diddly of what he promised. Instead, he used that power to save Wall Street. And Obama brought us this disease called Biden. He's the one that sabotaged the elections, the last elections, and got Sanders out and unified all those idiots, including Kamala Harris and Pete Buttigieg, who in Arabic, Buttigieg means the father of chickens, and the most artificial man, as one commentator has said, united them pushed for Biden to be, and he's still actually lobbying for Biden along with that other criminal, Bill Clinton. And that's the state of affairs, and that's why Biden is going to lose this election. If anybody can help it, we're going to do everything possible in the Arab community, in the anti-Zionist Jewish community, in the Christian community that's being massacred right now in the West Bank and in Gaza. We're going to do everything possible to so that he is not rewarded for the massacre that is happening now. And with that, we're going to switch to more optimistic news, and that is on the topic how the arc of history bends towards a free Palestine. And this is another long interview with Abdel Jawad, who is interviewed by Electronic Intifada, by Nora Barros Friedman, and by Ali Abu Nima, about why does he think that the arc of history bends towards a free Palestine. So let's have a listen, and that's what we're going to play out the show with.
Ali, let's bring on Abdel Jawad.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
But it's been way too long. Many apologies for not having you on a lot sooner. Good. We missed you. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi, and thank you, John, for that, as usual, extraordinary update. Now, I'll just say what's striking to me among so many things is how relentless it is. Like, after 6 months, they are keeping up the pace. And I know that provides, I want to choose my words carefully. A lot of people note that the resistance continues. They take note of that.
Yeah, there's no question about that. And to see the second that the Israelis enter these areas, they're resisted immediately. And like I said, Zaytun was a fierce battle before this. And so there's no indication of any kind of degrading of these forces in their ability to fight. And the resistance is courageous and effective.
Yeah. And Asa, hi. Hi, Asa. Thanks for coming on as well. Aboud, let's start with you. Do you want to comment on the report that John just showed us, especially the attack that happened close to where you live and work in the West Bank?
Yeah, I mean, I think John did a great job outlining the heroics involved with Mujahid's operation. And also pointing out some of the paradoxes of having people who are trained through, what was supposed to be a counterinsurgent force faced by the Americans after the Second Intifada, now becoming resistance fighters that can pull off an attack that was, as John said, also reminiscent of another attack in 2012, Ayun al-Haramiyya, or Wadi al-Harami attack. I think what is important here is also the extent of which we see a type of post-heroic Israeli form of warfare at display. And for me, throughout the 6 months, Israel in the past used to be able to us with its operations, its intelligence, its meticulous planning, its ability to assassinate, its ability to reach targets. And I think one of the factors that we have seen transpire beginning from the October 7th until today is that the Palestinians as a fighting force have been able to create this awe effect rather than the Israelis. The Israelis have lost any ability to capture the imagination of people through the organization of violence. This is happening whether it's in the West Bank or in Gaza. We've seen all around. And actually, Israel built its reputation on military prowess. It built its reputation largely on its ability to be daring, to be innovative, creative, to show heroics of the new Israeli hero who stands in the face of danger and can pull off tricks And I think that's been lost. I mean, what we've seen from Israel is just monstrosity, its ability to shock without awing people or without creating that kind of effect. And that's happening also in West Bank in terms of, you know, for the past 6 months, you had an intense campaign of derailment of the Palestinian resistance that, you know, was coalescing around these kind of dense urban spaces that we've talked about a lot before, refugee camps in the north of the West Bank. But for 6 months, this nascent, semi-organized resistance has been able to still persist, to maintain the capacity to resist, to reformulate its tactics. And it's still capable of producing IEDs, engaging in clashes, and in also conducting offensive actions that we've also covered in the past episodes. And I don't want to go back and do that. And one of the latest, attacks was the one in the Ramallah area, which has also a particular, let's say it's true, it's a lone wolf attack, most likely, using this kind of old rifle. So that also indicates, no real organizational links, etc. But it shows this kind of will on the part of also Palestinians in the West Bank to participate in whatever form or manner possible for them throughout this war. And this is just one example of it. That's my take thus far. And I think, when you talked, John, about Tahrir and his operation, in 2002, when his operation was conducted, with the amount of soldiers and exact hits, because I think he had 26 people hit by his rifle, people thought that he's a well-trained sniper. And we discovered later on when he was arrested that Tahrir had only grew up in Silwad, which is a village near Ramallah as well, knows the geography very well around Silwad, used also similar to Mujahid's operation, positioned himself well. It's an area, actually, the meaning of Ayun al-Haramiyya means the eyes of thieves. Historically, it used to be a place from which thieves would launch attacks on caravans moving from Jerusalem towards Damascus because it's a low area. And in that operation, he hearkened back to his skills that he developed as a young child watching his grandfather hunting. And it also tells us something about the Palestinian resistance and its in many instances, even if you don't have training or these complex military formations that we see in the Gaza Strip or, across the region in the form of Hezbollah, et cetera, that the form of embodied knowledge of people's daily experiences, their own memory of them well when they conduct such operations. And in the case of Mujahid, this combination of him being trained as a presidential guard member and at the same time knowing the geography of his own village very well and using those two combinations was pivotal in his ability to conduct a successful operation where eight Israeli soldiers were hit, one eventually died.
Yeah. It must be, Aboud, thank you for that. I mean, it must be really terrifying now to Israel and the Palestinian Authority. They've always had this kind of fear that members of the so-called security forces who are trained under American and European auspices and with their funding could turn against Israel. And that happened in 1996. I'm probably the only one here who remembers that. I don't know, maybe others do. But, in 1996, during the so-called tunnels incident, when Netanyahu, who was prime minister for the first time, opened this tunnel under Al-Aqsa, which was part of the effort to take over it, to take over Jerusalem, take over Al-Aqsa. And it sparked battles across the West Bank and very fierce armed engagements between Palestinian Authority forces and the Israeli enemy. And the Palestinian forces actually liberated certain areas. They liberated Joseph's tomb in occupied Nablus, and the Israeli soldiers there had to surrender or be rescued. And then Yasser Arafat actually handed back the liberated areas to the occupier, which is something I never understood. You liberated them. Why did you give them back? But since then, how do they handle that fear or tension? I mean, you need these security forces, if you're the Palestinian Authority in Israel, to repress and torture Palestinians and to hand them over to Israel. But at the same time, they have guns and they have families and they have feelings and they're part of the Palestinian people. How do they manage that tension?
I mean, it's a specter, I think, that haunts, first of all, the political class in the West Bank that runs these organizations, but also the Israelis. And you've rightly pointed this out. I think that, in essence, what we even have seen in the north of the West Bank is an indication of this slow erosion of the relation ties, the Fatah base, if you want, coming from different social classes and this political class embodied in the president, the current president and security heads and some of the financial interests that exist in the West Bank. So this is a long-term trend. We've seen this kind of unbinding. And I think Islamic Jihad has pounced on this opportunity by building its base in the West Bank. And the Islamic Jihad is significant here because unlike, for instance, Hamas, which has this kind of internal rivalry with Fatah, in fact, Islamic Jihad, a lot of them historically came from the Fatah base itself and have the capacity to easily navigate within the Fatah social base in Tulkarem and Nablus and Jenin and other areas. So we have seen a lot of the fighters in the north of the West Bank coming either from security services themselves or their families are security service members. So this is not necessarily only Mujahid and his case in the Bzia and what we've seen in terms of the operation. This is a larger trend that tells you that the ideological power through which the PA and its political class maintains control over its own base has been eroding. However, having said that, that does not mean that there's not sort of a stratification between certain members of the security system, the leaders, the geo class that, you know, handles the security services, and also, you know, the rise of, let's say, a current within Fatah that says that we're losing this historical moment. You know, the train of history is passing us by. We're not being engaged in any sense. And that the current leadership is leading, you know, the Fatah movement towards disaster. There are these voices. They remain unorganized. They remain outside of any kind of real power within the movement itself. And I think there's an intricate policing of these security services that is done constantly by its backers, meaning that when they see or notice or even smell that one of the members of these security services is slightly coming back to his senses in terms of, you know, that a new direction should be taken. We see, you know, the political class taking decisions of removing him from his post or sidelining him or retiring him or other forms of ways to sustain a security force that does not have a political posture as an organization. However, as individual members, these things can completely go against, you know, any form of, you know, if people are betting or wagering that most of the security services would not fight against Israelis, that they, I think that would be the wrong conclusion to take. Most of them would fight. The problem would be that they will, how would they fight as an organized force, or would they fight more as, you know, small cells out of their own? And at this moment, all we can say is that it's out of their own volition. Nothing like an organized element exists, at least for the moment.
Abdeljawad, can you talk a little bit specifically about the significance of what's happening in and around Jenin? We see the Jenin Brigade's members, affiliates being assassinated by Israeli drone strikes. And then, as Tamara reported, there were clashes between people in Jenin and the Palestinian Authority security services during the funeral processions. Can you talk a little bit about how this is all playing out specifically in Jenin?
I mean, in Jenin, what has played out in the past couple of months and intensified since was that, you know, Israelis have taken a more offensive approach, repetitive, attempting to basically break down the resistance that has developed in the past 2 years or so in the new year. However, what we can say is that despite the fact that now we can't talk about, you know, self-defense zones, areas where from which the resistance operates and remains almost fixed, the resistance has been more dispersed, mobile, has been attempting tactics of evasion, but at the same time been running more offensive actions. We have seen some of it around the settlement, the illegal settlement of Homish, which is near Jenin, and also the return of repeated gunfire attacks on Jelame and other areas. Now, the Israeli policy of this offensive maneuvers deep within Jenin is also using more air power, including the use of F-16s, for example, in one of the incidents, I think, in Nablus, the use of drones. Which is also harkens back to this form of post-heroic warfare of not necessarily engaging head-on with Palestinians, but a form of killing where you don't expose yourself to the risk of being killed. Something that we have seen, play out in Gaza and also playing out in the West Bank. At the same time, the Palestinian Authority has been using this kind of vacuum, this offensive by the Israeli military to arrest some of the members, to also fight the ideological symbolic fight within the Palestinian society in Jenin. And it revolves around the infrastructure that Israel has destroyed in the Jenin refugee camp, including the roads and the water and the electricity. I mean, just to give you a sense, you know, Tul Kerem, Nur Shams camp and Jenin refugee camp, a lot of the civic infrastructure has been actually totally eroded by Israeli bulldozers and D9. And there's, of course, this kind of ideological fight where, you know, the PA would use rumors, the Palestinian Authority would use rumors, would use, you know, this notion that resistance is not effective and cannot and should and is highly costly and people should turn away from it. It's part of this pressure or lever of pressure that we have seen increasing by PA or Palestinian Authority mouthpieces and people who represent their interest in Jenin, in Gaza, and other places of the inefficacy of resistance, and therefore convincing the civilian population or the Palestinians at large to place pressure on resistance fighters and groups to seize the resistance, surrender, or hand themselves or turn themselves in. And along with that, the PA has been trying to engage in provocative fashion in arrest of key members within these groups. So there's a lot of, you know, built up anger towards the Palestinian Authority. And it's not new that clashes would erupt or that the resistance fighters would shoot at Al-Muqata'a in Jenin. This has been happening for years now. It's almost like a hobby for the resistance fighters. And it's also an indication that they refuse and reject the form of policies that the PA represents and the security forces, you know, working alongside the Israelis to quell the capacity of the Palestinians to resist in the West Bank.
Thanks so much for that. Yeah, I mean, what can we say about this time when the resistance in Gaza is working to defend Gaza from the enemy occupier and the genocidal acts, as at the same time, you know, the resistance is reemerging, as you've said, across the West Bank. What does this say about kind of the general atmosphere in Palestine, where, you know, things are coming to a head, where, you know, like there are land grabs that are being resisted. There are settlement expansions that are being resisted. There is, you know, very open genocidal intent by the Israeli ministers. You know, I'm thinking about Ben-Gvir just, you know, deputizing the settler communities. So what does this say about where the Palestine, you know, liberation struggle is at this time, when we see what's happening across Palestine? And what are we not seeing happening inside 48, inside, you know, what's considered to be Israel?
Do you want the good news or the bad news first?
Good news first.
I mean, it's always hard to like give a sense of where things stand. I mean, because there's like historical material or flows and, you know, that operate to produce this moment. And I think like any other people in the world, when you see this form of monstrosity in Gaza, of course, the first reaction is total fear, no? I mean, people are afraid. And when they're afraid, they're paralyzed in many ways. So there's this kind of, you know, spectacle unfolding, but at the same time, that kind of fear that what's happening in Gaza could easily happen in the West Bank, that the Palestinians in the Gaza are also from the same, you know, cloth and blood and of the Palestinians in the West Bank. And there's nothing that really would safeguard the Palestinians here from also a genocidal attempt. Actually, the West Bank is the prize for the Zionist movement, and driving the Palestinians from the West Bank would be, you know, the most important, you know, element, specifically for its fascist right wing, but also for the whole Zionist movement as such. So I think people are coming to recognize this truth. However, there's always a difference between recognizing a truth theoretically and between letting it sink in. And the West Bank and Jerusalem and Palestine 1948, or the Palestinians within or half citizenship of Israel, you know, have not accumulated power in the past 16 or 17 years since the Second Intifada. That's the thing that actually made Gaza distinct, is that since the Second Intifada, there has been a constant accumulation of innovation, technologies, techniques, tactics, and of various, including organizational power, that enabled 7 October to happen, enabled this resistance to withstand a six-month genocidal campaign with, you know the tons of thousands of bombs being dropped on Gaza and still being able to resist through meager means and under siege. I mean, that has been the case in Gaza. There has been an accumulation of power in the West. That accumulation has not really truly happened, at least on an organized fashion. And that's the case also for Jerusalem. That's the case also for Palestinians in 48. So it leaves people in, I think, a sense of loneliness at this moment. And we talked about this, if you guys remember. I mean, I don't try to, like, you know, mince things or give people too much hope when there's, little hope. But at the same time, you know, we talked about this in the sense that there's no social movement that can organize people. I mean, there's no social movement that can organize people can withstand. And there's a lot of reasons for that. People feel lonely. People feel like they're individuals. They're, you know, they live under this kind of totalitarian, authoritarian regime, both, you know, the fascist totalitarian Israeli regime that treats Palestinians as subhuman without any rights and looks at them as people to be, you know, killed or ethnically cleansed or erased, and an authoritarian regime in the form of the Palestinian Authority that sustains or that has built its entire, you know, edifice and language and political, the notion of killing the capacity of Palestinians to resist. That's what makes it relevant to centers of power in the US and Europe, also for the Israelis. So within this formula, I mean, the Palestinians in the West Bank have to face this kind of dual structure. And they've also been very creative. Even lone wolf attacks are a creative form of, you know, moving beyond, you know, organization as such with leadership and cater and, you know, social movement, but at the same time still being effective and being able to hurt the Israeli settler infrastructure, being able to remind the Israelis that there's still creative agency among the Palestinians. But also now, at least in the north of the West Bank, there has been this rise of a more organized movement. So we've seen some signs, but again, at least in the West Bank, it remains a very and highly not a collective moment where, you know, all regions of the West Bank are participating in. I mean, we could say, and I agree with John when he says there's a, you know, you could call this an intifada, but I would say that it's an intifada in the north of the West Bank. Just to, I wouldn't say it's in Hebron or in Bethlehem or in other areas. And I know this kind of distinction might not matter, but it matters because at least when you live in the West Bank, yes, there is an active revolt and insurgency in the north of the West Bank, which has been, you know, I think for me, I haven't anticipated the level of steadfastness that this resistance has showed. I thought after October 7th that with the pressure, because it's a new movement, that, you know, things will become very dire. And because Israel has unleashed its, power, it's not really worried about, you know, its international image. It will use more force that, you know, the resistance will not be able to withstand it. But despite after 6 months of an intensive campaign, it's, you know, we've really some even signs of development in resistance in terms of IED capacities, in terms of what is being smuggled in terms of, so not only has it been able to withstand despite the numerous assassination and arrests, but also even develop and innovate or at least create more maneuvering space and more power in accumulating it. So that's been, you know, a highly significant factor. As for Palestine 48 or Palestinian citizens of Israel, I mean, it's a tough place to have your everyday life being embroiled within already, you know, within a state that is going into war. You know, Palestinians in 48 work in the Israeli market. They have an intern everyday level with Israelis. I think in many ways, their feelings around this war, their solidarity around this war exists. I think they also feel a sense of being paralyzed. But in the past, also 20 years or so, we've seen the national movement there dwindle in terms of its capacity to organize people and convince people. We've seen the rise of, you know, armed gangs in many of the Arab communities within Israel. We've seen, you know, with signs of violence being turned inwards rather than outward. And that does not mean, just to qualify that could not turn in a spontaneous fashion against the Israeli state. But what it means is that, again, there's very little form of organization to be able to meet the pressure that you need for this such a moment. And when we're waiting for a spontaneous moment, a spontaneous spark comes from more an active side. It comes from how people are, you know, reacting to the scenes they've seen. But, you know, again, the monstrosity that have unfolded in Gaza have also managed, at least momentarily, to cripple a lot of Palestinians out of fear. It's a legitimate feeling to have, but that's what has been happening, at least for now.
Yeah, and Aboud, I don't know if we can say it's a turning point, but when you talk about a moment or a spark or a spontaneous moment, if you just look over the last 2 days, the massive protests in Jordan, and there have been constant protests in Jordan. They're not shown in the media, but they've sort of regained energy. And that's also in a context where the regime in Jordan is doing everything it can to allow what they would consider safe outlets for people's emotions, but while maintaining a tight hold on any kind of anything that could develop into practical support for the resistance. For example, they prevent Palestinians, they prevent Jordanians, excuse me, from getting anywhere near the border. You can be sure that the Jordanian security forces are making sure to try to interdict any weapons reaching the resistance and so on. And of course, Jordan, as we've discussed, and our colleague Tamara has written about, is helping to do kind of PR for the genocide by doing these airdrops of aid. But nonetheless, I just think it's notable that the popular sentiment is there waiting to be activated and mobilized. In the West Bank, you know, the fragmentation, the fact that people are physically separated from each other into all these different little enclaves and separated from Jerusalem has to play a part in that. But nonetheless, I what I hear from you, and I think is a semi-successful part of the Israeli strategy, is the destruction of any or the attempt to destroy social organization. And in Gaza, for everything it's been through and the siege it's been under for so many years, people still had the ability. You still have mass organizations in Gaza in a way that perhaps they're not allowed to operate in the West Bank. So those are notable differences. But nonetheless, when we look at the big picture and the arc of history, so to speak, how long can this suppression work before the occupier's control is lost? I don't know the answer to that, but we've seen moments of it, like in May 2021, where it was really historic that you had simultaneous uprisings in the West Bank within 1948 areas, so-called Israel, and Gaza simultaneously. And this is something that Israel greatly fears, but to some extent they've avoided this time. Of course, there's a risk in saying that because, as we've said repeatedly, the scale of what's happening in the West Bank only looks small relative to what's happening in Gaza. But in historic terms, the amount of resistance, especially as you point out to the north, is actually very high, and people are paying a high price for it. And I think the steadfastness is there, the social steadfastness, the fact that people are not saying, you know, guys, let's just live a quiet life. There is support for, I think there was a tweet the other day from Robert Satloff, who is one of the, you know, very influential Israel lobbyists in the United States and a frequent visitor to some of the Arab tyrannies that have normalized relationships with Israel. And he was lamenting a poll that came out recently. I don't know how reliable these polls are, but in any case, the poll showed very high support for the resistance and October 7th among Palestinians, including and especially in the West Bank. And so, again, I just point that out to say that the potential is there.
I mean, I agree with you, Ali. I think that, you know, we have seen, historically speaking, the flow of resistance being sometimes concentrated in Palestinian history in the Shatat or the diaspora, then coming back to be with historic Palestine. There's always resistance everywhere. I mean, as you know, Basil Araj, who's a martyr, was killed in 2017, would say there's not a single day that would go by without a resistant act. And he was right by saying that. And that includes in the West Bank. Every day there's, you know, hundreds, if not tens of resistance acts. But what I wanted to just point out is that sometimes when you have this kind of organized movement in the Gaza Strip, and when you have the ability to face off with the Israeli military on military terms and ground, and in other places that is lacking for a lot of reasons. Also because, just to point out, that a lot of the civil disobedience forms of operation within the West Bank are also not available for people. So if you demonstrate on friction points, you're just a sitting duck waiting to be killed without feeling your own efficacy. And you know, tactics do not come up from just people sitting in a cave somewhere and thinking them. They come up from this kind of interaction with their concrete situation, with their everyday life, with what happened if you demonstrate. If you're just a sitting duck, maybe you should not be a sitting duck. So for a lot of Palestinians, at least when it comes to the West Bank suffers from spatial distance from its colonizers, like Gaza, without an organized movement that can supplant it and help it overcome that with the form of, you know, offensive actions that we have seen taking place, or with ballistics and, you know, weapons, armaments, and etc. Having said that, I mean, the other point I would just mention is that sparks or spontaneous sparks are not something that could be easily predictable. I mean, we all thought the PLO leaving Lebanon, ending up in Tunisia, being completely exiled, you know, without any borders between it and historic Palestine, without that struggle, that would be a low moment in the Palestinian struggle, until in 1987, the first Intifada happened. So 5 years, 6 years later. Nobody can anticipate when a spontaneous spark, but the signs are there. Because whenever there is any form of resistance, it means that there is a will. It means that people have creative agency. It means they're thinking about their condition and attempting to break this condition, open new political possibilities. And it means at any moment, this form of parallel that we're seeing, at least now, it's of course temporary. It doesn't mean that it's going to be lasting, or it doesn't mean that it's going to be something of a permanent one, especially since Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza live in the same horizon, which is a horizon of erasure and being annihilated. And that is clear from what Israeli leaders are saying, from the settler movement that has now been armed with hundreds of thousands of rivals in the West Bank, with the expansion of illegal settlement, the largest, biggest take up of land since Oslo happened, I think yesterday or before yesterday. I think Tamara wrote an article on it. You know, so these things are moving. It's a moment where people feel a sense of fear, disorientation. However, I would never bet against Palestinians' ability to generate resistance, not because I'm being here romantic or fetishizing it, but because I've read history quite a lot, and I've seen how Palestinians have you know, again and again, been able to create these moments that nobody have anticipated. We've seen the last one in October 7th, but, you know, down the line in other locations and geographies, we'll see something happen and transpire.
Yeah, and look at the big picture. The Palestinian people have been fighting not just Israel, or resisting. You know, the word fighting suggests the Palestinians were minding their own business in their country when the world came to them. They didn't go to Ukraine and Poland and Russia to pick a fight with other people. But the Palestinian people have been resisting for, you know, 75 plus years, not just Israel, but the world's biggest imperial power. Zionism was sponsored and was, to a large extent, a creation of the British, and then briefly became sponsored by the French. That was a short interlude, because I think the Zionists could see that France was going down the drain, just like Britain. And then it latched onto the United States, which is its current sponsor. So now the Palestinians are resisting the United States, all of Europe, Germany, and other great powers and institutions, and yet they are undefeated. And that is what gives me hope, ultimately, that Palestine will be liberated. Because think of all the ways that these powers have devised to try to defeat this people, to try to crush them, to try to make them lose hope, and they failed. And it's also been policies not just of brutality and murder and killing, but also bribery. And that was a big theme of the, you know, of so-called economic peace from the period of Salam Fayyad and Tony Blair, when he was the representative of the so-called quartet, where it was very explicit in their discourse and their documentation that we're going to turn Palestinians into consumers. We're going to give them mortgages. We're going to give them credit cards. And there was, in fact, a huge explosion of consumer credit in the West Bank. People, you know, encouraging people to go into debt with the idea that they will become so concerned about paying off their debts that they won't want to engage in any kind of politics or resistance. And none of that. Yes, of course, you can point to individuals or certain segments of society that have been bought off in every anti-colonial struggle that happens. But as a people, as a nation, the cause, and as a global cause, the cause of Palestine is only gaining strength. And that would be encouraging, and it's, you know, that would be a cause for celebration were it not also in the context of this ongoing genocide. But, you know, I just always take heart from what you say, Aboud, that the potential is there, and I believe the result will be it's inconceivable that this Zionist project can survive, but none of us can say, and I'm thinking back now to our discussion with Ilan Pappé last week, that this colonial project is coming to an end. But every colonial project, the end is horrifying and bloody and terrible, because these colonizers don't go quietly. I mean, they will not take the hint. And they also can't learn the lessons of history, that phrase that we hear from time to time. That leave quietly, let people go, let them have their liberation, because they're going to take it from you in the end anyway.
I mean, yeah, I mean, the arrogance, yeah? Nora, please.
No, go ahead.
No, I mean, I didn't want to say anything. I think Ali for me encapsulated the arrogance that also was, you know, their tragic fall on October 7th, underestimating the people that you fight, no?
Yeah, and it's completely, it's shattered their psychology. I mean, you know, Israel was sold to them as settlers, as this, you know, safe, impenetrable, you know, the highest military, you know, force, and it was shaken by guerrilla fighters who haven't given up. Anyway, we are about out of time with you, Abdeljawad Omar. Finally, like, I don't know. How do you see this, you know, now 6 months? What are the things that you're watching carefully in the West Bank from where you are? And what is kind of standing out significantly to you when you see what's happening in Gaza?
I mean, I think for me, when I look at Gaza, and I think I'll be honest here, I think when the war started, I did not anticipate the extent.
From WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Severe weather is hitting parts of the Midwest and East Coast today with torrential rain and high winds. 27 million people are currently under weather alerts that include wind warnings, flood watches, and winter weather alerts. In the past 24 hours, there have been 12 reports of tornadoes across 6 states. Meanwhile, around the Great Lakes, heavy snow and wind will continue today, with blizzard warnings for parts of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. After today, severe weather will take a pause for a few days before targeting the Plains states this weekend. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals today is hearing arguments over Senate Bill 4, a controversial immigration bill that would allow local and state law enforcement to arrest, detain, and deport people suspected of crossing the border illegally. The Biden administration filed a lawsuit saying immigration enforcement is explicitly under federal jurisdiction, according to the Constitution. Immigration rights advocates, who also oppose the law, say it could lead to racial profiling. If the legislation is enacted, it would become one of the toughest immigration measures in any U.S. state. In international news, at least 9 people were killed and over 900 injured this morning when a major earthquake struck eastern Taiwan. The earthquake was measured at 7.4 magnitude by the U.S. Geological Survey and was felt as far as Shanghai and China's southeastern provinces. A tsunami warning was triggered but later lifted. The quake and its aftershocks caused one building to completely collapse and at least 100 buildings have been damaged, according to local officials, though the full extent of the damage is still being assessed. At least 24 landslides have been reported, as well as damage to dozens of roads, bridges, and tunnels. At least 70 people are trapped in rock quarries. Taiwan sits on the Pacific Ring of Fire, a region of the Pacific Ocean that is home to most of the world's earthquakes. Today's quake was the strongest to hit Taiwan in 25 years. In 1999, a 7.6 magnitude tremor struck central Taiwan, killing more than 2,400 people. After that earthquake, one of the worst in the island's history, authorities mandated stricter building codes. And the bodies of 6 humanitarian workers killed by an Israeli airstrike Monday were transported out of Gaza and into Egypt today, ahead of their repatriation. The killed aid workers include 3 British citizens, a Polish citizen, an Australian, and a Canadian-American dual citizen. A Palestinian man driving the workers was also killed, and his remains were given to his family for burial in Gaza. In acknowledging the attack, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called it, quote, a tragic case of our forces unintentionally hitting innocent people, close quote. The Israeli military, which has killed thousands of children in Gaza, said it is conducting a thorough review into the incident. World Central Kitchen said it is pausing operations immediately in the region and will be making decisions about the future of its work in the region soon. At least three other aid organizations have paused or are considering pausing operations following last night's attack. According to the United Nations, more than 200 humanitarian aid workers have died